Spock, sabotage the system. Spock, restore the atmosphere. Spock, sabotage the system. I wish I knew what to do. Observations, Mr. Spock.
Okay, do you have line 193 again with sabotage, cannot sabotage?
I don't say sabotage. You say sabotage. I say sabotage.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to Pod Stallions. I'm Brian, and with me always is Jason.
Hello, everybody.
And today is a very special episode. It's all about our mutual love of My Little Pony, Friendship is Magic.
It's about time.
Yes, it is. It feels good to finally confess my bronydom.
We wanted to do a brony episode from episode one, really.
Really, yeah. It's always been there, and it...
Brian's been holding us back.
Yeah.
Because he doesn't want to get beat up on the way to school.
More. I don't want to get beat up more.
Beat up more.
Yeah.
On the way to school.
I don't need to give any more reasons.
That's right. He already wears that Star Trek helmet.
I'm already a 43-year-old man going to grade school. I don't need to be.
But if you haven't figured it out, we're not doing an episode on bronies.
Yeah.
Although we should, because
yes.
It is phenomenal. You know, there is a documentary out.
About saw it.
The whole brony phenomenon.
Watched it last Sunday.
You did, was it good?
It's excellent. Oh, and wow. I have gone from thinking it was creepy to just not getting it.
No, I'll tell you what's creepy. There's another documentary out called I Think We're Alone Now.
Yes, I've seen that too.
Which I wanted to watch, and I thought I'm just going to feel dirty when I watch this, so I can't.
I did.
You can do a documentary on anyway, but that's about people that are obsessed with Tiffany and
yeah. There's the one fellow. He clearly has a bit of
but he's got issues, right?
Yeah,
he's
Asperger's. He doesn't understand. I view him as I thought he was fairly harmless, and you know this okay. I just want to say this because it's kind of I was thinking about this before the show. This brony documentary.
Mm.
If you 20 years ago were sat down and said. Pick the future that is a movie and pick the future that is real.
Mm.
Disenfranchised young men start fight clubs and create a terrorist organization called Project Mayhem to bring down consumerism and capitalism. Or B, they become fans of My Little Pony and attend conventions for men only who love this children's girls cartoon. You would automatically pick the fight club as being the more
you would. And it's future. So. It's so subversive that I start to think, is there
a fight club underneath a brony convention?
Yeah, or is there like a hidden? Are there subversive messages in that I'm missing that are really talking about something else within the show? I mean, do you remember the whole? There was a time, and by the way, Powerpuff Girls is coming back to get way off topic, which I always thought was a brilliant show, brilliant animated series because it was so weird. But there was a lot of subversive stuff in Powerpuff Girls where that was one of those shows I thought that – I mean people say Tiny Toons, but Tiny Toons to me was always written for an adult audience. It was always too clever for its own good.
Yeah.
But the Powerpuff Girls was very much for little kids, but there was – do you remember the Lebowski episode?
It's been a long time since I've seen it.
There was an episode where the woman that was like his Girl Friday or whatever, she gets kidnapped. And they come to the mayor's office, and he hands them a ransom note, and it's they read it just like the dude. He's in front of a fireplace, and he's like, "Do my tears surprise you, girls?" And it's right out of Lebowski, and that was like you know in 2000 when Lebowski hadn't really you know blown up as the cult thing that it ended up becoming.
Yeah.
That's different than this Friendship is Magic, I think. I always feel like there's something really subversive going on that we don't know about. Because I haven't seen enough of it as well.
I don't play, the only thing I thought of when I saw this is I thought, you know, my daughter might enjoy this show. But I never personally, you know, I don't need to understand everything that goes on around me, as long as I'm, you know, I watched this thing, thought, yeah, you know, I dress dolls a lot, so maybe I shouldn't be hucking any, you know, cinder blocks out of my glass house. So, I'm cool with it. I was just fascinated by the phenomenon, and I still don't get it, but.
But I will say this.
Mm-hmm.
The toe that I did dip in the pool, I do have the Comic-Con Derpy Hooves figure from a couple years ago that I got at Comic-Con.
I sadly know that.
Opened it and put it in my display case because I think it is absolutely brilliant that they got away with that and subsequently can't call the character Derpy on the show. Or I think in subsequent releases they couldn't call it Derpy Hooves because Derpy has now become this term, which is ironic because the new dog we've got, Bowie, who's sick going on 6 months, who's wonderful. But, you know, Henry is very much – Henry's very kind of reserved. He's a sweetheart. He'll sit in your lap within 10 minutes. But he takes his time to kind of get to you, and he's just a gentleman. This guy is like a bull in a china shop, but he's just – he's indestructible, and he's always hitting his head on things and trying to jump up on the couch and cracking his head on the coffee table. And just – and when I just start calling him Derpy, like he's just kind of Derpy.
It's funny how a word becomes – a descriptive word.
Oh, I love it. It's
yeah.
Exactly what it is. But so. Speaking of subversive and Derpy.
I don't think that's a good segue.
I don't think it's a good segue. But I think we have a really cool episode. This is something that we have mentioned many times. It comes into many of our conversations. I think it's a huge part of both of our childhoods, especially Brian's, with the collecting aspect involved, in a couple of ways. And that is the phenomenon of a little something called Star Trek.
Yeah, and what was your gateway to Star Trek? Was it an older sibling?
You know, it's funny. I was trying to think of this before the show. I'm not sure where it started. I do know that my brother Jack, my oldest brother, is a big Star Trek fan, always has been, and he may have sort of been the first one to turn it on. I don't know, but it just seemed to be one of the earliest shows that I sort of obsessed over. You know, besides Saturday morning cartoons, it was a Saturday or Sunday. I always remember it being on Saturday or Sunday afternoon.
You're absolutely right. That is, I do not to hijack yours.
No, no.
I thought it was a Saturday morning show.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, because my sister was in love with William Shatner, and she was going to marry him.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had to watch Star Trek every Saturday morning.
Mm-hmm.
And I was sort of down with it because it was spaceships and, you know, so there's two fundamental things, and one of them is embarrassing. One is I thought it was just another Sid and Marty Krofft production.
Oh, that's interesting.
Because, you know, it's – you know, when you look at those planet sets now, and I love the show, don't get me wrong, but they kind of – like they kind of look like, you know, Jason of Star Command or stuff was almost on the same production quality level,
right?
You know, with special effects and everything by the mid 1970s. So I didn't quite distinguish between the two.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that I honestly can't believe, I thought Star Trek took place in present day.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. When you first started to see it, you thought it was a current show? You thought it was as current as whatever was up on, you know, on a Friday night.
No, I thought it was a new Saturday morning show.
Okay.
But I thought, because I think I'd seen the Gary 7 episode, and they're kind of sneaking around during modern day.
Okay.
And I thought that Star Trek took place right now, and it's a secret project.
Oh, that's interesting.
And that was probably like 1975, 1976, I came to this assertion. I did not change my mind on that until the movie came out and there was a Marvel comic adaptation of the movie and it said the 23rd century adventure begins. And I was like, oh my God, Star Trek's in the future?
So wait a second. So are you telling me that you thought the footage you were – like you thought something like the Starship Enterprise could have existed in current day?
I thought it was a top secret project. Yeah, I mean, like, I don't think I put a tremendous amount of thought into it.
You know, that's really interesting how your brain – what's interesting to me that we're talking about this is we always have said this many times on the show. They're, and I think a lot of our age group can sort of say this, for better or worse, whether you went with, you know, that boat or not, the world did sort of divide up into pre-Star Wars and post-Star Wars. Doesn't necessarily mean when Star Wars hit that you loved everything Star Wars was and that was it, but your brain tended to open up more to the world of sci-fi and outer space and the future and lasers and robots and things like that. You know, after Star Wars, it certainly became more prevalent, but it became more interesting. But this is we're still talking about a world pre-Star Wars, and I would say that I was already interested or fascinated with outer space and spaceships and, you know, laser guns and things like that. Something, you know what I mean? Like, I think you either kind of into Westerns as a kid, maybe, or, you know, into, I mean, we all watched Starsky and Hutch and stuff. We all played Starsky and Hutch. Yeah. But something about the sci-fi thing that already kind of, you know, turned me on.
Well, we're kind of children of the 70s. We didn't see Star Trek on TV in prime time syndicate or prime time series. We were that second wave where the show got a second chance at life, and it was unheard of that a 72 episode show would have any sort of life in syndication.
Well, let's talk about that real quick, because I was going to hit it later, but it's fine that you
okay.
hit it.
Yeah.
Well, because I think this is really fascinating. I've always thought this, just in the worldview of properties, the story of Star Trek is already fascinating enough that it got a pilot that was deemed, as everyone knows, was deemed too cerebral, and then got a second pilot, which was unheard of at the time, is still kind of unheard of, that you would ever do something like that, that you would throw that kind of money at something that you had that much faith in, but it got a second pilot. It struggles when it's on the air. It gets publicity. It gets magazine covers and stuff, and a fair amount of merchandise that wasn't exactly within canon. It struggles, as everyone knows, the fan writing campaign got that third season. It gets a third season. But already by 1973, so the show goes off the air in 69. So 70, 71, 72. I mean, you can read stories about, Shatner going around the country at this point, going around the U.S. in a station wagon with a little trailer hooked up behind it, doing theater, living out of this little trailer because he was getting nothing for residuals and not making any money and not doing anything.
Well, I think I watched a documentary not too long ago, which is good. I did, called Trek Nation, which Eugene Roddenberry's son does. Uh-huh. And one of the things mentioned was there was like no profit sharing for the Roddenberrys till the 80s.
Oh, I didn't know that.
So Gene Roddenberry was doing all kinds of, TV pilots and running around trying to make money for the family. You know, like once Star Trek was done, he was broke. Well, not broke, but there was no money coming in,
Same thing for the cast. I mean, when people don't think of this, they already make enough jokes about it. But I mean, like some of their residual checks, for a year could be, $50 kind of thing for doing those shows. But what's fascinating is that already, and when you think of how long it takes to amp things up and to get shows going and get things made, by 72, let's just say 72, when did the MIGO license kick off?
The MIGO license kicked off in 75.
75.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is even before somebody said, hey, this is doing well enough that we got to start doing some serious toys. And this is kind of unheard of too. I mean, I don't know how many times in pop culture / toy history that something gets that second lease of life in the toy world that is more popular than it was when it was on the air and the stuff sells, like gangbusters.
Well, I don't know if I've ever told you the story, but the guy at MIGO, Neil Kublin, who was the research, he told me that he had to fight for it because he came home and his son was watching Star Trek.
Mm.
And he said, he went back to Marty Abrams and said, this Star Trek, kids are watching it. And, he got the opposition. Oh, it's old. No, we're not doing that. And then he finally said that once Marty Abrams acquiesced, he just let you go with it. So
interesting.
So he said, eventually he just said, fine, do it. And he got the license for $5,000 or something like that.
Wow.
And he said, I bought a Corvette with the money that I got bonus.
Wow.
because it was huge.
When you think about it, and you say kids were watching it, like there really wasn't anything to whet that appetite. So it was, you know, what it was, even though it was already a little dated. But already by 72, there is enough life in this thing. And again, this is a time, you know, when they talk about comic books, you know, 40, 50 years ago, they weren't getting an issue out on Wednesday and by Friday looking at the results. You know, they weren't able to look at the trades and go, this is what the share was last night. You know, for comic books, it was a month before they could look at the numbers that an issue sold, where they would go, oh, that character actually is doing pretty well, and start to build that momentum and change that curve. So already by 72, word is out that this show has got this life and is getting, you know, ratings and syndication, that Filmation jumps on it and says, let's do an animated series. Uh-huh. And from that time on, you know, you had 66 to 69, then there's nothing. Then 73 comes along. You get two more seasons for the animated series, which I don't know if a lot of people know this. I think for the most part, Star Trek fans consider those stories within canon. Of the stories that were made. And within, you know, 3 years after that, there's a motion picture. And then it never stopped. So this thing really didn't have much downtime. I mean, it certainly did for the actors to wait to hear what was going to happen. But it was from 72 on, it was always sort of in the consciousness, which I think is remarkable. Like the series wasn't a success. Then it gets an animated series off a show that wasn't much of a success. Then it's big in syndication. Then the toys hit in 75, and we'll get to those in a second. Then the movie comes out, and it has a whole life as a movie series, as a series of movies based on a failed TV series. I mean, I know this is a broken record, and it's been written about and talked about 1,000 times, but I don't think that can be discounted, just how remarkable that story
is. It's the little engine that could, isn't it?
Yeah, like, it truly is.
Yeah.
And it's not like something like Doctor Who, which we've talked about, where it had this amazing life and the networks were what they were back then. There wasn't as much to watch, however you want to put it, however long it outlived its usefulness. But it came back, it went away. I truly think that the wrong person could have brought it back in 2005. The right person did. I don't agree with everything Russell T. Davis did, but it was the right guy at the right time. And it had been away for the right amount of time to have built up its legend to come back. I don't think anyone thought it was going to be quite as, you know, huge as it's been. But it went away for the right amount of time to bring it back with gusto. Whereas Star Trek was the slow burn, and then people started going, well, yeah, we'll try this and try that. The toy thing, I think, is a remarkable story. So for me, my memories go watching it in syndication, mm-hmm. Watching it with my brother, both brothers, Jack and Gino, but Jack especially. And, you know, my brothers are like 10 years older than me. So when I'm, you know, 7, 8 years old, 6 years old, my brother Jack is, you know, like 16, 15 or so. And so we would wrestle, you know, afterwards. And, you know, I thought I was tough, like I was beating my brother occasionally. But, you know, he would be the Gorn and I would be Kirk, or, you know, I would be Spock or whatever. And then the toys, that happened very quickly. And I didn't get all the toys, but, you know, Kirk, Spock, McCoy, Klingon. I think I had Scotty, the Enterprise.
Oh, you had the bridge?
The role, yeah, I had the Enterprise.
Oh, I wanted that. I never got it.
Do you remember how I did your the intro of your book?
Right.
And I talk about a place called Borgstrom Pharmacy.
Sure do, yeah.
That's where I got my Enterprise bridge. And,
wow.
And you know, I don't know if your father ever did this hilarious little trick that he'd pull on his children. You know, where he'd do these things like, hey, you want to meet the real James Bond? Come on in here. Come on, let me show you. I'm like, James Bond's going to be in here?
Yeah.
He did this several times. And then it was, he knew how much I loved Planet of the Apes because I had some of the Planet of the Apes stuff. And he said, yeah, you want to meet the real Cornelius? And it was like, this is either going to be Roddy McDowall or a guy dressed like Cornelius. I don't know what.
Yeah.
It was just some dude that worked at Borgstrom. His name was Cornelius. And for like 5 minutes, I got excited. And then but that's the guy that handed me the bridge. Like my dad, it was up on a shelf, and I got the Enterprise, and I loved. I mean, I played with that thing I gave it such love and took such care of that thing, but I was obsessed, and that's where I stored the figures. But boy, you can take it from here because you're such a Mego head. I can count maybe 5 toy lines. You know, it's different now when you're doing it now with all the hindsight and guys like us that are in the captain's chairs making this stuff and saying, I want it to be like this. And the head should be more like this. I always wanted the one from back then to be this, so I'm going to do it different. But when you're talking about In the Eye of the Hurricane, that has got to be one of the top 5 toy lines ever made.
Oh yeah, it's definitely it burned brightly, not for a super long time, but it was the hottest thing I think Mego had in 75, because you think 73 they launched the superheroes, 74 they had the apes, and you want to talk about if they had been charting ratings by demographics, they never would have canceled that Planet of the Apes TV series because it was all kids watching it. You know, just millions of children. And
that was a big – I'm sure we'll do an Apes episode. But wasn't that a huge thing for Mego too?
It was. But it was dead by the time the show got canceled.
Okay.
But it still sold okay. Afterwards. And I have articles and all kinds of interesting stuff about that. But Christmas of 74, the hot Mego item, and it was on all the top 10 lists of toy sellers and that sort of thing, was the Apes Treehouse. Okay. So then, you know, moving to 75, Star Trek kind of just appeared. Mego just kind of like, you know, it was 2 pages in the 1975 catalog just showing the bridge and only 5 figures. And by that Christmas, the bridge was the hot item. You know,
besides, I guess what I'm trying to say is besides actual sales, like when you look at Mattel doing Battlestar Galactica, for example. They made some great action figures. They made some ships that were very true to the ones in the show. And then when they started to get into like role play, they grabbed, you know, an existing Japanese ray gun that they grabbed the mold of, which was like, you know, that white sort of pistol with the egg on the end of it that they
used. Yep.
Flash Gordon animated and Battlestar Galactica, stuck a sticker on it, made noise. I'm saying that the guys in the back room that were designing this stuff, they seemed to have a true love. They could have probably just put out a laser pistol, stuck the Star Trek sticker on it, and it would have done just fine. But they made this stuff for the time as closely as you could have with the communicators and the phaser, which was ideal. Was the phaser ideal?
The phaser? No. Remco made a phaser. Mego made a phaser target game. And
okay. The one that has the discs that go in the front that light up the silhouettes?
That's Remco.
That's okay. I have that one in the box that I picked up a few years ago for a song that still makes noise. And I had that original, and I played with it and played with it. And it was the coolest weapon in the house. But I mean, across the board, you know, Mego, they were very close to the characters, the sculpts, the uniforms, the bridge itself. It's a beautiful toy line overall, wouldn't you say?
I would. And you know, I spoke to a couple of the people. And one of the things of Mego in that time was they were just hiring hardworking young people right out of art school. And I spoke to a gentleman a few years ago by the name of Vinny Baera, who worked in the Mego R&D department. And he was like, I was a fan. I love Planet of the Apes. I love Star Trek. And it shows, you know, and these guys put a lot of creativity. And a man by the name of John McNett, who worked there, was the guy who kind of came up with that epic 70s toy invention, the transporter playset.
Awesome.
And I mean, that thing sold that playset like no tomorrow. I can still remember that commercial as vividly as I did when I first saw it in 75.
It's a genius toy. There's little to no tech involved with that thing.
And the thing doesn't look anything like the Star Trek bridge.
No, nothing. But it's brilliant. I mean, it's such a cool. And I'll say this too, the sculpts are fantastic across the board. The character sculpts for the Star Trek Mego line are fantastic. And in Shatner in particular, and I think I've told this story maybe to you before on air. I don't know. You know, when you go to sculpt someone like Leonard Nimoy or DeForest McKelley, there's so many great bits in the face. There's so much character. There's so many lines. And
there's a thing you can catch.
There's a thing you can catch that because they have a much more interesting face. Two of the faces that are the most commonly sculpted in toy history and also the most difficult to capture, ironically, are Harrison Ford.
Oh, of course, yeah.
And William Shatner. And it's because, I mean, Ford's got certainly more goofiness to his face than Shatner, with the nose crooked and the scar, whatever, that you can sort of play with. But in the history of all those sculpts, besides the stuff like the high-end Hot Toys kind of stuff that just gets lifelike, in the history of all of that, I still maintain that the two best that were ever done were Kenner doing the Han Solo 12-inch figure, which became the Indiana Jones 12-inch figure of Harrison Ford.
That's good likeness.
And that Mego Shatner. Mm-hmm. I still think that is the best overall likeness ever done of William Shatner, is that Mego figure.
It's also probably the smuggest Captain Kirk action figure ever made.
That's just it. It captures both that and actually that one, McCoy is almost a little too happy, but the McCoy and Spock and Kirk perfectly capture those characters.
Yeah, Scotty's a little off.
Well, he's a bit drunk.
Yeah, yeah, maybe that's it.
It's the Romulan ale, I think.
Yeah, they are great toys. I had just the five, I think just the crew members and the Klingon are the only figures I had as a kid. And I played with those from 75 till when Wrath of Khan came out.
Oh,
I still played with those.
And still my pet peeve obsession with any figure that has a holster where the weapon can go in the holster, you know, that, or that kind of thing, either it's an action figure, whether it's a 3¾-inch or whatever, started with those utility belts that came on the Star Trek figures, because, you know, I was aware enough to know that the superhero stuff that I got, not that I was expecting a bunch of accessories with my superheroes, but I was aware enough to know that it was the same company doing this stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, each one of those Star Trek figures came with 2 to 3, you know, extra accessories that went on the figure. And I just loved that. And I still love that about those figures. Beyond the toys, which I think we both, you know, had those figures, I had the, like I said, I had the phaser, I had the communicators, which never stopped playing with those things. I had the Vertibird thing.
Yeah, the Vertibird? No, I don't think that was called, I can't remember, but Vertibird was the Mattel word for it. But
I had the Enterprise one.
Wow.
Picked up a shuttle and picked up something else, picked up some chicks. I had that thing. I had coloring books. I had the Punch Out and Make It book, which I used to be obsessed with the Punch Out and Make It books. You'd actually had. I had that coloring book, that ridiculous coloring book theater
did
with the Clown Planet. I had that very coloring
book. For everybody, I will post a link. If you haven't seen it, you need to see it. And I got scans of this. It's this 1975 Star Trek coloring book that is so unbelievably, well, unintentionally hilarious. They go
it's
to
fantastic.
It just needs to be seen.
It's fantastic.
And the way the guy draws Sulu is just.
And for you clown fetishists out there.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
You're in for a treat. Speaking of weirdness, I also would get the occasional Gold Key comic. Or compilation.
I
have a couple of compilations, which really did my head in, because I really thought there was another. I'm not being funny. I really thought with some of this, there must be more episodes or another season or something that I haven't seen.
You're as bad as me.
Because the artwork was so off key and so off copy, you know, the gun, everything. I mean, the guns were plain as day on the show. I don't know how you could screw up the guns, but everything about it was just wrong. And it was
what you didn't think, just off to the side of the Enterprise were just huge levers and wheels that men had to crank.
Well, and everyone, either some of the stuff seemed a little too cerebral for me in a comic book, or it was completely insane, stupid. But none of the characters acted remotely within character.
No,
how they did on the show.
They were pretty much interchangeable.
Interchangeable. I also had the we talked about Power Records before. Power Records had every license under the sun back when companies could do that. And they had Star Trek. And so I had some of the Star Trek Power Records stuff, which, again, we should post links to some of the YouTube stuff that's out there that people have put up Power Records. The guys that were doing those voices are really good. The guys that are doing impressions of Shatner and McCoy and Nimoy.
They're not bad, yeah.
They're pretty good for such things. But here's the big question. Clothing-wise, did you have any Star Trek clothing?
I did not. I remember my parents taking me to, like, the, you know, the Teen and Tot store.
Uh-huh.
And they had the Don Moore Star Trek shirts, the crew uniforms, and I really, really wanted them, and my mom was just like, I don't think so.
That's so funny. Same. I remember distinctly those store displays. I know walking through that going, oh, they've got, and that is that, because I thought at first, this is my 5 or 6 year old brain. I thought at first those must just be displays of, like, uniform shirts. Like, they're probably not for sale.
Yeah, but they were kid-sized.
Yeah. And I remember wanting one, and either my mother or father probably thinking, you're going to get your ass kicked if I get this shirt. I can't. And then they said, no, how about this one? And it was a long sleeve, blue. It was a white shirt, but the sleeves were blue. It was a long sleeve blue shirt, and it was Spock holding the phaser, kind of looking up to the corner. I think I have a picture of myself wearing that thing somewhere. So I had that because, much as I loved Kirk, Spock was kind of my favorite character. And this will lead to, I've got a little list here of things we should talk about. This will lead to specific episodes because we have a lot to cover here. So specific episodes, were there episodes that, because, you know, the we didn't always look at the TV listings and know which. Sometimes a listing would just say Star Trek, you know, 4 o'clock or whatever. You didn't know what the episode was, and we certainly didn't know titles of episodes. Were there episodes where they came on and the first 5 minutes you go, oh, this is the one with the – and you loved it or you were looking forward to it or anything like that?
With the specific episodes?
Yeah, with the original series.
Believe it or not, I don't think I ever watched all the original series enough to get that. I was a fan. I liked the Gold Key comics. I bought those, but I'd never seen them all.
Okay.
And there was a summer of, because it would only come on weekly, and it was a summer of 81 where, you know, you're not, like, I wasn't old enough to work, and I think, or was it Wrath of Khan? Maybe it was 82. I can't quite remember.
Yeah, Wrath of Khan was summer 82.
Okay, summer of 82, Buffalo 29 played Star Trek every day, twice a day.
Okay.
And, you know, I was 11 years old, and I would get up on a, you know, I think it was like on a 10. So usually I was able, my mom wouldn't kick me out of the house till like 11. And so I managed to watch a Star Trek every day that summer. And I can even remember my parents went to buy furniture somewhere, and they left me in the TV department so I could watch the Enterprise incident, or, you know, one of those episodes.
Came back hoping someone would grab you.
Yes, yeah, just take.
Come back out. Now he's still here. Shit, we gotta take him home. Come on, Brian, it's time to go.
It was.
Good luck next week.
It was a Stewart's department store, and there was a really obnoxious guy that used to do these yelling commercials, and I was watching Star Trek, and I turn, and my dad's yelling at the guy from the TV commercial.
That's surreal.
Yeah, that was surreal. But
well, I had a thing because I sort of, you know, I kind of loved Spock. Like, there was just something about his mellowness, and he was tough. And I mean, I really loved Kirk. Like, Kirk was the guy.
Yeah.
But I had a soft spot for Spock, and I guess he was kind of my favorite. And so there were certain episodes that bad things happened to him that, I'm, you know, very honest here, as a kid, were hard to watch.
Oh, yeah.
One was Spock's brain. that was tough to watch.
That's got to be, like, one of my absolute favorite episodes.
It's kind of fantastic.
I love the stupid ones.
But that was tough to watch. The other one was, there was an episode with the hippie one is fantastic.
Another one of my absolute favorites.
Where they go to Eden.
Oh, yes.
And they sort of bond with Spock because he was, you know, people don't realize this.
He jams.
Trekkies do, but people don't realize just how, even when the show aired originally, just how hugely freaking popular Spock was.
Oh yeah, especially he was the big deal
with the chicks, because he hit it just that time where comic books were big on campuses, and the, you know, Tolkien stuff was big on college campuses, and the whole peace movement, and Spock was, you know, sort of embodied all that. He was, you know, an otherworldly guy and very peaceful and everything. But he got and she got a ton of hate mail. Nurse Ratched. I almost said Nurse Ratched. Nurse Ratched.
She did too.
That would be a great mashup. Cuckoo's Nest and Star Trek. But Nurse Chapel got a lot of hate mail because she had the hots for Spock. The episode where they go to the planet with the apple, is it called the apple?
With Vol?
Well, all those like sort of man children and women that, you know.
Yeah, I think it might be called the apple.
Imigo made the playset.
Yeah, it's sort of based on it. Yeah, that's Apple, and I think that's a young
David Soul.
David Soul.
You're right. It's David Soul. But in that one, he gets shot with a flower in the chest.
That's right.
Okay, he gets struck by lightning. And then something else happens all in one episode. And that was always a tough episode for me to watch for some reason.
A lot of wear and tear on the Vulcan.
A lot of wear and tear on Spock. But one of my favorites was called The Gamesters of Triskelion.
Oh, I venture 30 quadlubes on the newcomer. Yeah.
Yeah, it was another the third. You could always tell when it was getting to the end of a season because Shatner would take his shirt off less.
Yeah.
Because he kind of put on a couple of pounds.
And that's the episode famous for softcore and I think later hardcore porn star Angelique Pettyjohn, who was that statuesque woman that was in that
with the white hair?
Yeah, and I think they sold posters of her from that episode at one time.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I remember seeing in the back of magazines. And she got around, that lady, but in more ways than one.
I'll say she did.
But she, for some reason that episode is, it's a good romp, that one, I think.
Well, because there's one moment where they're fighting and somebody throws a spear and hits the big guy like in the stomach.
Yeah.
And the spear goes right, like I thought that was the coolest thing, like that was an ultra violent, you know, anytime Kirk would really, you know, fight and stuff. I love the one Journey to Babel with his Spock's parents because
that's
there were so many
terrific one.
Cool looking monsters on it and different faces. I loved Amok Time where Spock and Kirk have to fight, of course. Everybody loves that one.
Or somebody once called that Spock Gets Horny, which
is pretty much
my favorite description of that episode.
But you know, it's funny when you did you ever see a movie called A Face in the Crowd? It was Andy Griffith's first screen credit, basically.
No.
It's 1957. Ilya Kazan, I think Bud Schulberg, I think wrote the script. It's like a 50s version of Network. Like when you watch Network, which was 75, 76, it really was supposed to be a warning call, like don't ever let it get this bad with television and personality.
And we sure listened, didn't we?
Sure listened. Well, Facing the Crowd, 1957, same thing. Like he's this character from the South called Dusty Road or Lonesome Roads or Dusty Roads or something. And, you know, at first it's just this homespun stuff on the radio, then it's local Memphis television, then he becomes nationwide. And he's a megalomaniac, but again, it's all about. They were trying to say, don't let TV – I don't know. I'm going down this road, but what I'm trying to say is there's so much steamy innuendo. Even 1957, you know, like he'll go in somebody's – of this woman's room and somebody knocks the next morning and his suitcase is still out in the hallway.
Yeah.
Well, you know what's going on in that room. Like they couldn't believe when I saw it again years ago, like how much they got away with, how much is implied. In the late 50s, we know what we're talking about. You just can't say it. Well, that episode of Star Trek is really very much like Serling did with Twilight Zone. You know, there's a great interview with Serling he's talking to someone like Mike Wallace or somebody just before Twilight Zone's going to air. And he's talking about sponsors and how it can be tricky sometimes writing teleplays, because you've got to think about the sponsor. You know, you wouldn't do a particular topic and then think about the manufacturer of a thing that's going to, you know, be in a commercial or something. So he'd already been known for, you know, Requiem for a Heavyweight and some different, you know, television things. And I remember the interviewer says, so this new series, The Twilight Zone, will you be tackling anything political or, you know, sort of heavy-handed in your news? And he's, and Serling, just cool as can be, smoking a cigarette, he's like, oh, no, of course not. No, we won't. These will just be fantasy stories in the science fiction and fantasy, you know, vein. But no, there'll be no controversy and no political. Well, you know, sly as a fox, he knew that if he did it under the guise of something else, that he could get away with this stuff. And Star Trek had a fair amount of that in when at its best. People forget how good that show was. You know, there's a lot of stuff to laugh at, but I think at the time there was nothing that, you know, next to maybe, you know, Twilight Zone, or how smart Twilight Zone could be, to that was as cerebral as Star Trek.
And when there were some really amazing allegories in there. And then, you know, but people often kind of point to the, you know, the Sharons with
it's, yeah,
very obvious where that's headed.
And the one with the, there was another one where the society basically is just pressing a button and 2 million people are eliminated. And then other side goes, oh, we got to eliminate 2 million more. And then they press a button and then it's all about the big wigs, you know, hanging back. There's one about, you know, miners and their rights when the other people are living above the cloud sort of
thing.
I mean,
miners,
some of it was heavy handed, some of it, you know, wasn't. But the Spock thing, you're basically talking about him getting all horned up and having to get some action, or he's going to, you know,
explode. I never knew what he was going to do.
Go crazy. Oh, you knew. So I liked those. And then there was another one I was going to mention that was a great episode. The one where I forget what it was called, but it was anytime Spock would act differently.
Yeah.
Something would happen to make him act. There was one where he and McCoy get stuck in a cave in prehistoric times.
Yeah, they made a All Our Yesteryears. They made a photo novel of that
with a young Mariette Hartley.
Yeah, really? And he reverts to primitive Vulcanism,
yes,
because it's back in time.
And Bones takes and Bones was such a racist. He was such a racist.
Cracker.
And he grabs Spock and, you know, calls him a hobgoblin or something. And puts him up against the wall, and Spock turns him around and goes, "I don't like that. I don't think I ever did." And he's about to, like, rip his head off. That's another thing. I'm rambling now. But one of the geniuses of that show, if not the genius bit of it, forget we're all going to be living in the future and all races and creeds and no money and all that shit. That's all great. The genius was hitting on the trio where Spock is the captain and McCoy is the right hand, and, you know, Spock is the left hand, and Spock is logic, and McCoy is all emotion, and Kirk has to find the middle ground and make the decision.
I never looked at it that way, but you're right. It was the three bowls of porridge, wasn't it?
Absolutely, and that's why I think it worked so well, as you had that, you know, all the other characters, and, you know, as much as they get, I'm going to go on a quick little thing. Everybody has given Shatner shit for so many years. Every secondary character, every guest star, they have all complained for 60 years, 50 years, about Shatner being an egotist and looking for the spotlight and, you know, not remembering their names and all this stuff. Well, the fact is, and I'm not excusing any bad behavior if there was, and I'm sure there was, he was the star of the show. He was an established guy before this, and this was a network series show, and he was the lead, and Nimoy was the next lead, and then McCoy, and they were there, you know, 6 of the 7 days of the week. So if it was Uhura or whoever else, they might have had 1 or 2 days that week in a script, and the rest was about those three. So,
yeah, they were part timers, the rest of them.
They were, I think he's gotten way too much stick over the years, and I don't think there's any way to downplay just how terrific. Again, back to those three guys. I'm rambling again, but those three performances. Yeah, you can. There are 8 million Shatner impressions out there, and I'm sure he would do things sometimes, and other actors would look around and go, "What the hell is Shatner doing? Like, what is that thing he's doing?" But I don't think it can be downplayed how significant his acting was in that and what he brought to that role, because he's acting his best friend has no emotion whatsoever, is not, and that was a genius. He should have won every award out there every year for that show, what Nimoy did with that character. It's a genius portrayal.
Yeah, it became something that during our time, didn't Nimoy write a book, I Am Not Spock?
Yes.
And like later on wrote a book, Okay, I Am Spock, and you know.
Yeah.
I'm waiting for a third version where, well, maybe I'm not, or
well, I might be.
Yeah.
Now that you think of it, for $75 for an autograph.
Yeah. Don't make eye contact with me.
But it was really, I mean, that's a really tough thing to pull off, to have no emotion and to.
Well, you know that originally that role was offered to Martin Landau.
Yes, that's right.
And he said something to the point of, I don't think I want to play that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can't quite remember because I read it in Starlog when I was a teenager, but. Lando said something to the point of like, no, that didn't interest me, playing it with no emotion.
He should have said, have you talked to my wife about the part?
Yes. She's awesome.
She'd be great. She wouldn't need a script. She would be great. Yeah. Yeah, no, it's interesting. And I don't think it's dated a bit when you look at Nimoy's performance in that show. And DeForest Kelly is wonderful in that performance. He really does a great job. And he's not likable. I mean, especially some of the earlier episodes, they make him very unlikable towards Spock and kind of a racist, because Spock is very different, you know, for all the reasons that he's different. So we're watching the show. So it's syndicated and it's a kind of a ritual. We watch it on the weekends, whatever. Do you remember when you realized, of course you don't, because wait, you just told me you didn't realize this. I realized it was an older show.
Oh.
I'm now into the Star Wars world and everything else, but Star Trek is still, and now it's become a rivalry where my brother will give me shit because he thinks Kirk is cooler than, you know, Han Solo and back and forth. But I remember then, you know, trying to catch whatever the principals might be in. Like, there's James Doohan in Jason of Star Command.
You mentioned that. That did come to me later on, because in Canada, all of a sudden Shatner had a big permy head of hair, and he would be on the Joyce Davison show, or he would be doing those Loblaws commercials. So Loblaws? I Bob Loblaw at Loblaws grocery store. So I started to realize that the show was not new or no longer in production. So yeah, I did catch on to that. And
did it make you a little sad?
No, because a lot of stuff I watched was old. Like I used to watch, you know, Three Stooges and Little Rascals, and you know, they were all dead. So,
you know. Well, no, but I would get a little sad. Like, I would watch In Search Of.
Oh, yeah.
Which Nimoy, you know, opened and closed and did the narration for. It used to scare the crap out of me, that show. There were so many episodes that were scary.
Yeah, it was definitely eerie and had a lot of atmosphere.
But when I would see him, you know, in the opening of that, it would kind of make me a little sad. Like, oh, we're never going to see those guys together again. So this is weird that for some people hearing this, that we're talking about now a world post-Star Trek series, post-Star Wars, that people are starting to talk about the possibility of the show coming back in some way. And I'm not sure when I first heard about it or read about it. The merchandise is out there. It's still popular. Kids are playing Star Trek on the playground and all this stuff. It might have been in Starlog. Could I have been looking at Starlog even back then to read something about a Star Trek movie? But as most people know, it originally was going to be another TV series called Star Trek Phase 2.
Yeah, which is – there's a really great book about it.
Yeah. I don't know what it's called, but there's supposed to be a really great book, and it basically would have also launched a fourth network, which would have been the Paramount network, which eventually got launched, I think, when they launched Voyager, right, in 1995 or something.
Yeah, it took a long time to get that off the ground. Yeah.
So, but it was this back and forth because of Star Wars. We should do another TV series. No, it should be a movie. No, it should be a TV series, and we could do a whole episode just on motion picture and what a missed opportunity that thing was, because there were these scripts apparently that went round and round and round. Like there weren't a dozen different storylines. You know, here's the great Federation Klingon War. This one's about the Gorn invasion. This one's about the. It just seemed like two or three different stories, all kind of about the same thing, all very, very cerebral. And it really was, you know, the reason that it was even happening, that was being talked about, was because of something like Star Wars. Paramount wanted a Star Wars. They wanted it to. They thought, we've got this thing. It's big already. It can be huge. Because of, look what's out there for Star Wars. Well, Star Wars was pretty much Flash Gordon, Buck Rogers in a blender with popcorn. I mean, it was,
yeah.
You know what I mean? There was nothing really deep about Star Wars. It was, that's why we've talked about this too. Like, you couldn't have, and we're both into Doctor Who at this point, probably, yep. You know, when Star Wars comes out. You could love Star Wars along with everybody else and talk about it and wear a Star Wars t-shirt to school. You could probably wear a Star Trek one, but at a certain point, there was that delineation between Star Trek being kind of nerdy and Star Wars being much more popular and much more mainstream.
Yeah, I'd like to point out that I used to think that Star Wars fans were cool and Star Trek fans were the geeky ones back in the 80s and 90s, and boy, that's changed.
Oh, well, the ultimate twist on that is Doctor Who.
Yeah, and
you didn't tell anybody that you watched Doctor Who.
No, you did not.
I mean, I remember a neighbor kid mentioning it once, and it was like, I thought he was, you know, like pulling a fat, like he was like with the CIA or something, just trying to get me to admit something. It was like, I waited until like the third question, and it was like, yeah, I've seen it. I know the show. Why do you watch the show?
Yeah, like, you kept nobody, that stuff close to chest, man.
Very, very close. So now this is happening with Star Trek, and it's funny, they wanted, I think they truly wanted a Star Wars style, you know, shoot 'em up adventure, but it kept, every script kept going back to this cerebral, you know, does God exist, you know.
Please take out all the action sequences.
Exactly. And I wonder, because it's funny you say how much it wasn't until a certain time that Roddenberry got, you know, what he got. He seemed to have a lot of say in what this thing was going to be from very early on. Yeah.
Yeah, he did. He seemed to have a lot of control and, you know, I don't know. I don't know the whole mechanics of it but he definitely, I think he definitely should have, because it was always his baby. And, but yeah, he was, there's a great book on Star Trek Phase Two that I own and I have read, but I haven't read recently, and it's really a neat glimpse of what that series would have looked like. And I honestly think that series would have been epically bad, personally.
I think so too. You know, what's sad is there was a initial, and it's funny because I got all the Star Trek films on Blu-ray.
Uh-huh.
And I used to have the Star Trek films on DVD, which was in this larger box set.
Uh-huh.
And they all were like double disced things. And you think that when the Blu-ray stuff comes out, that you're going to get all the stuff that was on the regular editions plus extra stuff. Well, for the most part, you did. But on the motion picture DVD, the Blu-ray.
I borrowed that from the library one night.
Well, it omits this amazing documentary that was on the initial DVD release that talked about the buildup to motion picture. And it was a huge, extensive thing on Phase Two. Even talked to the guy that was going to play the main Vulcan, because Nimoy wasn't going to do it. He ends up having a small part in motion picture.
Yeah.
And it's not on the Blu-ray, which really pissed me off. Plus, that version had the director's edition with the, you know, added stuff and updated effects, and the regular edition. This one, I think, just has the updated. But at a certain point, us fans start to realize that.
You know, you mentioned being sad at seeing something. The saddest I ever got was Shatner. During that summer that I watched all the Star Trek episodes, Shatner appeared on The Tonight Show. And I got excited, and my mom let me stay up and watch it. And all he talked about was cop stories.
Was it Hooker time?
It was Hooker time, and as much as I was a fan of Hooker because he was a good cop, it really disappointed me.
Let's be honest. There was a time when Shatner didn't have a sense of humor.
It absolutely. Yeah.
His resurgence and his. And let's be, I've met the man. I was lucky enough a couple years ago at Comic-Con that we thought there's no way. You know, you make these overtures and you think there's just no way that whoever's going to show up for a photograph. Would he swing by the booth with the Biff Bang Pow stuff, the Entertainment Earth booth, to do a photo op with his action figure we made from Twilight Zone, from his two Twilight Zone episodes, and the Mystic Seer. Limited edition, you know, prop replica we made. Never thinking in a million years he'd ever come by. And then he was going to come by. And it was like, I was cool as a cucumber. Oh, Shatner's coming by. And then my wife was down there, obviously, for the network or something. And she called me or texted me and said, I just saw Shatner. He's getting in a golf cart with some people. He must be on his way. And suddenly I'm shaking. Suddenly it's like 2 minutes to go and I am 8 years old again. And when he showed up and he came through the back of the thing, I was shaking. It was like, this is William Shatner. He's coming to me. And we got loads of photographs.
Did you hear that like dun, 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 dun type music from Star Trek?
Oh, everything was going through my brain. Everything, yeah. You know, but he's, you can't believe this guy's 82 years old. Like he's so, and he's also, yeah, okay. He's put on a couple of pounds. He's got a bit of a tummy. He put his arm around us, you know, for a photo and he's solid. I mean, he's like, he takes care of himself and he's just constantly on the go, this guy.
And he's a horseback rider, so he's probably got a super strong core, you know?
Oh yeah. And but something happened, you know, there's even those classic EPK interviews from Star Trek V that are so egotistical, they make you want to throw up. Do you remember that one that someone took and made into a remix? And it was like, why is Captain Kirk climbing the mountain? Captain Kirk is climbing a mountain. Why is he climbing the mountain? And yeah. They keep doing it as a remix. And it's just ridiculous how much he believed he was Captain Kirk. But somewhere, somebody said, you've got to start embracing.
Yeah, he went the other way and lightened up.
He went the other way and he totally lightened up. And he was probably awful. Like there's Mike Douglas Show stuff that – do you remember that time like before the motion – there's a great Mike Douglas Show clip. We should put this on. Where Christy McNichol is one of the co-guests, and he's talking about doing the. Oh my God! Now that I'm thinking of it, it's Ben. Why can't I think of his name? Jerry Stiller and his wife.
Ann Mira. She's still alive, isn't she?
Yeah, it's the two of them, Christy McNichol and William Shatner. And Shatner comes out in a velour long sleeve button down that is. I swear it's unbuttoned to the navel. And his big thing at that time was going around to outdoor, you know, Hollywood Bowl type stadiums and having the orchestra play science fiction music while he did spoken word stuff.
Yeah, I think he did. I think at some science fiction awards, he did Rocket Man.
Oh, my God. Well, we'll have to put that up.
With his WS socks.
That's one of the greatest. It's the Science Fiction Awards from 1978.
How did that get on TV?
He's hosting it. He's co-hosting it with Karen Black, which is effed up enough that those two are hosting this thing. But at one point, I'm not kidding you. This is so classic. As some of you may know, Elton John and Bernie Taupin were the co-songwriters for all that great 70s stuff that they did. Bernie Taupin gets up to the mic and introduces William Shatner, how proud he is to have William Shatner doing a version of Rocket Man. Has to be seen to be believed the way he does this. But he took it all very, very seriously. And somebody said, you've got to start opening up and making some jokes about this stuff at your expense. And he's bigger than ever now because of this. But there was a time where he didn't want to talk about Star Trek at all.
Yeah.
Whatever project he was working on, it was like a dirty word. And, of course, I'm sure you've heard the outtakes from the Star Trek animated stuff where he says something at one point, he's delivering a line and he says, Scotty, see what's going on. Spock, sabotage the system.
Oh, sabotage, yeah. And in fact, there's a joke that they play Sabotage, the song by the Beastie Boys, in the first J.J. Abrams Star Trek film as a homage to that.
Oh, is that what that is?
Yeah.
Because there's that one. He says sabotage the system. And then you hear the booth director go, can we try that again, Bill? What is the problem? Well, you said sabotage. It's actually sabotage. And then Shatner goes, you say sabotage. I say sabotage.
Yeah. I think there's another one that used to play on Howard Stern all the time that was basically somebody saying to Shatner, yeah, Bill, I'd like to do one more take. And Bill and Shatner goes, you don't talk to me anymore. Like, it's just this, really.
He says he does something wrong. Like, he's going, walking through a cloud, and he's like, I wonder what to do. I wonder what we should do. Spock, find out what we should do. And you hear the booth director say, yeah, can you try it again, Bill? It's like, you know, Kirk is like kind of – he's in a bit of a haze, and he's walking through a cloud, and he's just not sure quite what's going on. If you could just make it a little more, you know, unsure. And Shatner's like, oh, don't tell me how to do it. It sickens me. It sickens me. Both of those lines, sabotage, and somebody correcting Ben Stiller's character, and then Stiller says, don't tell me how to do it. It sickens me. Yeah. Both of those gags were used in Mystery Men.
Oh, okay.
99. So now that you say sabotage, that makes sense that they would throw that into Star Trek.
That's
So yeah, so that was a very sad time. Now, speaking of sense of humor, then we see Airplane 2, and yeah. Shatner has a part in Airplane 2, which is hilarious. I think it's the first time he really, you know, took to that and started kind of making jokes.
Yeah, he sort of did before Leslie Nielsen got in on the act, he did that. Or was it around the same time? I can't quite remember.
It was 1980 or 81, I think.
81. I saw that in the theater, so yeah, it must have been like 81.
So before I talk too much, we got to get to something that's very near and dear to you. Mm-hmm. And that is, we have a weird amount of merchandise, a weird array of merchandise for Star Trek that comes out when the show is originally on the air. Closest thing to canon being a disc shooting plastic gun with Shatner and Nimoy on the packaging.
Oh, you're talking about the 60s Remco stuff?
I'm talking about the 60s Remco stuff. And you had the Mego stuff. You had amazing rack toys. From
Azrak Hamway did a Azrak brilliant Hamway job
in the 70s. Just some of the greatest rack toys ever made were the Star Trek rack toys.
And to be honest with you, I have a theory that 1970s, mid-70s, the Migos, the AHI, the Remco, that stuff was pretty much the only time in history where children bought a ton of Star Trek stuff. The Mego Star Trek, the motion picture line, died a very terrible death.
That's actually what I'm building to, is that by the time we got to Star Trek the Motion Picture, it's official, it's coming out, it's been delayed, etc. It's going to come out Christmas, you know, December of 79. And because of Star Wars, and because of the history of Star Trek already, and because this is the first time we've got a motion picture, I think the merchandisers out there thought this was going to be the next Star Wars. And so for the first time, there was more merchandise for Star Trek than ever before, really. Wouldn't you say the 79 motion picture explosion was the most stuff that ever got released in one go?
It was a lot. I'd say at least they were prepared for it and they were expecting a boon. But it just didn't have the same effect that the series had.
But don't you feel that if it was – don't you feel like when you watch motion picture and we talk – I texted you a while ago because I put it on just for kicks. Man, the first 8-9 minutes of that
– looks great. I still always watch
– it's fantastic.
I've watched the first 8-9 minutes in the last week.
Because it's you when I sat in the theater and when you sit there now, it's very clear this is a movie. This is not
scary.
It's scary, and this is not a television experience. They're really trying to say you're not at home watching your television. This is CinemaScope. This is huge. There is outer space, and there are Klingons. And even though you're going, what the hell are those things? Why do they look like that? It's badass. The ships look amazing. The effects are incredible. And you know what? It's never as good as that for the rest of the film. Like that, imagine if it could have been like I say, the Federation Klingon War or whatever it was, but it was never that exciting or that good. So that opening, but don't you feel like as boring as the uniforms are, and as bad as Shatner's rug is, and all the other stuff, that if it were more of a slam bang action adventure, that the merchandise would have done a bit better than it did.
I think a bit better. I think also if they had have not drastically changed the look of everything. Like Paramount was trying to brand two things now. They were trying to say Star Trek Classic and Star Trek Movie.
Right.
And they went out of their way to change the look of everything to those. And this has always been one of my quibbles about the movie as a kid and as an adult. They all look like they're in their pajamas.
Oh, terrible.
And they should have kept more of a – I think they should have tried to – make the connection to the classic series, because you still had reruns of that running on television.
Yeah.
And then you have this big budget movie, and it would have been, it would have given everything a boost if they had have been more of a, more tied together a little bit. But I think bottom line is the film, the show had plenty of action. The film shouldn't have been so cerebral.
Right. There were, to be fair, we know that Mego did a load of stuff, you know, with the action figures and the 12-inch figures. Not their fault. Beautiful stuff. Not their fault that the look, overall look, was so boring. But there was some cool stuff made. There were the that really cool South Bend Enterprise that was made.
Yep.
That you could, that made noise, and it could discombobulate, you know, unattach and reattach into different ships. South Bend made a couple of phasers. That shot at each other. There was a great phaser squirt gun, actually, that was made.
That thing's brilliant. It's like getting the movie. It's like getting the movie or a cheap version of the prop.
Yeah, it's very, very accurate. So there's some good stuff there. And let's of course not forget, best of all, and used in many scenes in the film, the Star Trek the Motion Picture Space Glow putty.
Of course, yes.
Which
key
was
a scene.
A key deleted scene.
Because when Spock needed to get Beetle Bailey's face on something.
Spock loved the funnies. Mm-hmm. He loved Beetle Bailey and Mama.
Mm-hmm. And Hagar.
Those were his favorites. So, okay, so the movie, we got so much to cover here, but in so little time.
Very little time.
The movie actually, you know, did, I think the last thing I saw on one of those documentaries was it did like, the equivalent today, it would have done like 350, 400 million, you know, U.S. kind of thing.
Oh, it was a hit.
It was a big hit. But unfortunately, because it wasn't a Star Wars size hit, the rumors came down from Paramount that should we do a second one? How are we going to do it? You know, should we recast? You know, Nimoy was tough enough to get, and how are we going to blah, blah, blah. And the first thing I ever read about a second one was a little blurb in the newspaper, local newspaper, you know, upcoming things. And Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. And then I noticed it like in Starlog and here and there. And I don't know how – I certainly didn't go, oh, that's the Khan from the TV episode.
I never got that connection. Buffalo 29 had to play that episode like it was a special episode, and I figured it out.
You know, for those of you that don't remember it or want to go back, great story. This is all supposed to be true. Harve Bennett, who was one of the executive producers – was trying to think of what the next one's going to be, and he thought, well, let's try to connect it to the TV series. And he, according to him, over a weekend or whatever it was, he sat at Paramount and screened every single episode of Star Trek. And when he came to Space Seed, which is the episode with Khan, at the end of it, they're, you know, when they say, okay, we're going to send you to SETI Alpha 6 or whatever it is, at the end of it, Spock says something like, it would be interesting, Captain, to return in 100 years or so to that planet and see what has grown from the seed that you planted here. And it's like, yeah, it would be indeed. And he said, boom, that's it. That's what we got to do. Let's see. Let's go back and see what happened. And, of course, Nicholas Meyer gets on board to write and direct this thing. And there's a reason that it's the best in the series, and that everyone considers it to be perfect in so many ways. And did you see it in the theater when it came out?
No, because I had dragged my dad one Boxing Day to see the motion picture, and he hated it.
He left town.
And there was no way. The only thing he did was buy me the Starlog magazine.
Okay.
The making of Wrath of Khan, that special they did.
He's like, here, this will have to do.
He basically told me to flip the pages fast. Maybe that would make the movie. But luckily, that was like the advent of home video, and I think I saw it at school.
He's like, you're not getting me again.
Yeah, no, that was not happening. And I knew, I was like, crap. Yes, sir, I understand, sir. You know, I was fine with that.
He would have taken you to Porky's.
Yeah.
He's taking you to Wrath of Khan.
I did watch Porky's with my dad.
Well, I went to Wrath of Khan on a Saturday afternoon with my brother Jack, who hadn't seen it at that point. Already rumors were going around that something – spoiler alert for those of you that haven't seen Wrath of Khan. Already rumors were going around that something's going to happen to Spock in this movie. And I don't think I heard it, though. I don't think I knew that going into it. I'm so glad that I didn't.
Remember those blissful days when that happened?
Yeah, because we went to the movie. No, I take it back. We went to Arby's for a little bit of lunch. Before a little Minnesota staple, Arby's fast food, roast beef sandwiches. We went to Arby's first, got our sandwich and our black cow, went to the movie. And it's one of the few times as a kid or an adult that I cried in a movie when that scene came. I mean, I was riveted to this thing, riveted. But very much like Empire Strikes Back, it has a feeling of dread throughout that something bad is probably going to happen. And when that scene came up, whew, and then not only does that happen, the credits roll, and then you hear Nimoy's voice giving the
space.
Oh, and it's unforgettable. And it really was emotional, because I, as far as I was concerned, that was it. It was done. Conversely, trying to go to the store to find any kind of Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan merchandise, forget it. There was nothing on the shelves. Probably because the Star Trek stuff from Motion Picture was still on the shelves because it sat around for so long, right? Didn't it?
It was a dud, a huge dud. It was clearanced very quickly. And that's the other thing I wanted to mention was Wrath of Khan. I was reading in that Starlog magazine, and I really expected there to be just tons of Star Trek action figures out there again. And it was like, where are they? They have a new Star Trek movie. You make figures.
Nothing.
And nothing. And I think in the back of Starlog, they were selling those little miniature white metal. And I was like, well, these must be action figures. And I filled out that form. And, of course, I never bought them. But
I think it was TSR. Was that who it was?
I don't even remember. I just remember they're like white metal or something. And
they had ships. They had the characters and they had
Wanted
ships.
All those. Yeah.
But that was it. That was as close as we got, because we're gonna have to leave it there.
Yeah.
With Wrath of Khan, we could certainly go on to the rest of the films that were made and what happened to characters and the franchise and all that stuff. But I remember, I think to leave it with this, because there's something about this. You know how you sort of have a real fondness for the motion picture line
yes,
of toys?
I do. Yeah.
Do you? By the way, and I'm not. This isn't a. I'm not judging, but do you know anybody else who does? I mean, is there a no? I mean, is there a? I don't mean that like you're weird.
Why are you a freak?
I mean, is there an audience for that? Is there a following?
Yeah, there are. The aliens especially are very coveted. They're familiar to me because I liked them as a kid, but they were Canadian only release or Canadian in Italy, I believe.
Yeah, those weren't possible to get.
They were a dollar a piece when I was a kid because they were everywhere.
Wow.
Because Mego's distributor in Canada paid up front for everything. So even though Mego was like, oh, this black hole line bombed, we had no choice. We got them.
So I remember, you probably remember this as well, but there was a mail order company that I just started to get the catalogs of right around this time.
Yep.
And did for many years later, called Intergalactic Trading Company.
Of course, yeah.
And by God, those bastards, they're from Florida and they're still around. They've got a huge presence on eBay.
You know, you want to tie this in?
Sure.
I went to their store on my honeymoon And
what?
Yes, and my because we went to Florida on our honeymoon, because that's what smart people do. They go to Florida in July.
And you're still together.
Yep. you got to hear this. I rented a convertible. It had a CD player. We didn't bring any CDs. So while I'm at Intergalactic Trading Company, I see this thing called Golden Throats. And in it is celebrities who should never have released records.
Yes, they did volume one and volume two. I have both.
And I, my wife and I did think it was really funny for the half the day we were driving to listen to Shatner's Mr. Tambourine Man over and over again, because it was so funny. Like, it was so bad. We still joke about it to this day. If I say Mr. Tambourine Man, my wife will shriek it out.
My favorite bit is when he goes, hey, Mr. Tambourine Man. It's like that sort of...
I like when he says Jingle Jangle.
That's a brilliant... Both those records are kind of... are kind of brilliant, but there was a great issue, and it's funny because about a year or so ago, I contacted them and said, Intergalactic, and I said, do you by any chance have any old copies of your old catalogs? I will pay for them. I will, oh, hold on, pause. Oh, hi. See, I contacted them like a year or so ago and said, have you got any old copies of your old – because the catalog was like a newspaper. It was like a thin kind of a newspaper thing. And I said, I'll pay for them. Just make copies. I'd love to get copies. They had a great issue from 1984, which was like everything that was coming for 84. And in the catalog, there were – clearly now I realize they were taken from catalog pages from different toy companies – the Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom toys, the Star Trek III action figures from Ertl, the Dune toys by LJN, Ghostbuster stuff, Gremlin stuff, whatever was going to be coming out that summer into fall and Christmas, they had shots of. And that's the first time I saw that there were going to be action figures for Star Trek III. And it's such a weird, weird thing. It's kind of like that time that Tonka did toys for Willow.
Those were awesome. Yeah.
It's such a weird marriage. Like, Ertl? Don't Ertl do diecast things and trucks and all kinds of stuff? Like, it was such a weird thing. But that, to me, was us getting Star Trek II Wrath of Khan action figure. So they made – but here's the really weird thing. They made a Kirk. They made a Spock. They made a Scotty. And they made the Klingon played by Christopher Lloyd in Star Trek III.
I know. And they were in grocery stores.
They didn't make a McCoy.
No.
And they also made two die-cast ships, the Bird of Prey and the Enterprise.
Those were awesome.
But there's something about them that I just love. I just love those figures.
I have the prototype shots from a catalog, and they're using the Mego figures, which I always thought was hilarious.
Oh, will you put that up?
Yeah, I will try and find that. They just basically...
you got to put that
They just basically redressed the Mego figures to look more classic, and of course they just they made their own figures after. But yeah.
Oh, I'd love to see that. Of course, we've gotten loads of great stuff since. And the other thing that I'd love to get someday before I die, two things that are on my sort of end of life wish list. Dinky in the UK made a beautiful set of die-cast vehicles, the Enterprise and a Klingon cruiser.
That shot discs.
And the Enterprise came with a little shuttle that went in the back.
Oh, yeah. I used to have a set of those. I eventually, for space, I had to get rid of them, but I do kind of miss them. I had them in a gift set, too.
They're gorgeous. And they're just about the best on-model, I think, stuff that was ever done. I had, when I was a kid, the Remco utility belt that came with the phaser, communicator, and tricorder.
I'm wearing mine right now.
Many around your wrist.
Yes.
Many years later, I found one that was boxed. Boxed is a little beat up, but it's got the discs and everything that shoot out of the phaser. And the other thing is, I didn't find out until years later, probably through you, that Mego, along with all the other great stuff that it did at the time for motion picture, it made a couple of die-cast vehicles. Is that correct? No. Or did they just do replica vehicles?
They're not die-cast. They are models that you don't really have to put together.
Okay.
But they did the Enterprise, and they did the Klingon ship, and they did Spock shuttle, which is the real bugger to find. Okay. And I have all three of those. I love those.
But those are aren't those like the of that set of that time? Aren't those sort of the holy grails?
They're tough. They're really tough. When I was a kid dealing toys, there was stacks of them everywhere at a discount place I used to go to, and I used to sell them for $15 to Americans.
Isn't that funny?
Think I was a genius, you know?
You know what I do have, which I had at the time, and I picked up. Many years later, as so many of these stories go, many years later, I wrote this song. You ate certain candy bars and sent away the wrappers or whatever, including, I believe, the Summit Bar, which was a wonderful candy bar in America that died many years ago. It was built like a Twix, and there were two bars in it, but it was like a wafer with like peanuts on top and then wrapped in chocolate. Anyway, you sent away these wrappers, and you got this amazing mail away set of punch out vehicles from Star Trek the Motion Picture that you then made into a mobile. So there was the Enterprise, there was the Vulcan shuttle, a Klingon cruiser, the shuttle that he and Scotty take over to the ship, and something else. But they're gorgeous, and they're big. You know, this set came in a big manila envelope, and then you made it into a mobile. So I've got that. I should take pictures so we can put that up too.
Yeah.
But anyway, but that's a huge overview in a very short time of our love for Star Trek, from reruns to really to Wrath of Khan, when I think was its zenith. And wonderful things happened after that. But, you know, that's and I've been fortunate to meet Shatner, you know, almost like in a business setting, not like a fanboy setting. Of course, I was a huge fanboy. And the year before that, Nimoy was at Comic-Con for his last Comic-Con, just sitting at some table. And it was like I walked past him, and it was like a double take. Like, no one's even there. Like, he had just sat down. And then I went back and was like, holy crap, that's Leonard Nimoy. So then I got in line with like three people and got an autograph, and I got a picture of him. I met Scotty a couple of times. I'd met George Takei once with a friend while he was walking his poodle in Los Angeles. Come along, Muffy, we're going.
Yes.
Across the street. I've met Nichelle Nichols. I met Walter Koenig at some kind of comic convention. I mean, he was buying he buys like premiums, like serial premiums.
Yeah, he likes Pep pins and things like that.
Yeah, he was buying some pins.
Walter Koenig was my neighbor at a Star Trek convention in the hotel. And me and my friends were standing in the hallway, and he couldn't get his key in the door, and he was just swearing and screaming. And but it was weird. Like, we all just kind of took pause. Like, I'm just going to let him yell and scream. And
speaking of Koenig.
Yeah.
And a bit of a flaw. Oh, and I also met Kirk's son, Merrick Buttrick.
Oh, really?
I met him at the same Mary Tam convention that the first
time. Oh, wow, yeah.
Yeah, I got a picture with him somewhere, but I won't show you because I've got like peach fuzz on my upper lip because I was like 14, 13, 14, whatever it was. But what were you just saying? Koenig with the yelling and the
yeah,
rush.
Yeah, that was.
Oh,
that
okay. Was... Little nerdy flaw. And I don't think I'm wrong with this. If you watch Space Seed.
Chekhov's not in it.
Chekhov's not in it. He doesn't show up till the second season.
Well, yeah, but he could be on the ship somewhere.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Look, I'm willing. Look. Space 1999, the moon blows out of orbit, and in the second season, there's just like a whole new cast, and we're just left to believe that they were in the basement.
Well, they also have windows on the moon base that like open up.
Well, of course.
But in Khan, he meets Paul Winfield and Chekhov on SETI Alpha 5 or 6.
Yeah, and he says, "You, I don't know."
And he says, "But you, I never forget a face."
Yeah.
And it couldn't be, unless he was, you know, trolling around down the lower decks, which I don't think Khan would do.
Well, I always defer to what Lucy Lawless said on The Simpsons.
Yeah.
She said, every time you see something like that, just say a wizard did it.
Okay, so a wizard did it.
That's right.
Merlin must have been walking the halls of the Enterprise.
Right. I sleep well.
Anyway, that's enough for all you guys to chew on. Any of the things that we talk about on these shows that we've wanted for many years and want to get a hold of, feel free to send us or send us money for. We're not going to say
got
no.
I've got no shame.
I've got no shame, and we think it's the least you could do.
Yeah, and I'm a size 15 in shoe.
I hope you've all learned something about Star Trek that maybe you didn't know before.
That's right.
But we thought it was long overdue to do a little Star Trek episode. So maybe we'll do a part two that goes from Search for Spock up to current stuff. That might not be a bad idea.
Could do, except I'm not much of a next generation fan. But
no, neither am I.
All right.
I'd stick to the.
Let's trash it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'll stick to these characters.
All right. Okay, everybody, live long and prosper.
Yeah. Peace out, everybody. Thanks for listening.
That was great, man.